Welcome to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. For a long time, climate change was framed as a matter of individual action. You should recycle cans, compost your veggie scraps, drive less, bike more. And that has actually been a tactic encouraged by the fossil fuel industry. They and other polluting industries have aimed to avoid systemic change by framing this as an issue of personal choice. The phrase carbon footprint was actually a term coined and embraced by the fossil fuel industry.
You see now that the oil industry will put out ads saying, it's on all of us to reduce our individual carbon footprints. Here's our greenhouse gas calculator. Make sure you're turning off your lights at night because that's way easier than them having to switch to renewable sources that are less polluting.
This is Emily Atkin. She's the journalist behind Heated, a newsletter and now podcast, which she describes as being for people who are, quote, pissed off about the climate crisis. Because individual action cannot reduce carbon emissions enough to stop climate change, many environmentalists have pivoted to focus less on personal carbon footprint and more on reducing the emissions of our society as a whole. But Emily Atkin says the coronavirus might be changing her thinking on collective versus individual action. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what are some of the problems of this frame of seeing, you know, actively fighting climate change as something that we only do by cutting our own personal consumption?
Well, because that won't work, number one. We can't solve it by cutting our own individual carbon footprints. It's climate change is such a huge problem that requires us to make such massive reductions in carbon emissions over such a short amount of time. It's not going to happen scientifically by just me and you making really inconvenient choices for ourselves, by me stopping eating meat, by you stopping driving a car, because we would need everybody to do that. And everybody's not going to do that. There has to be systemic changes. Scientifically, it's the only way we solve it.
So then take me to you in Spain, which is, I gather, where you were coming home from when you wrote this newsletter. And why was it that this moment with the coronavirus sort of was causing you to change your thinking?
Well, I guess I was already kind of feeling a little iffy about what I'd been doing just because I decided to go on this vacation to Spain. I usually never feel guilty about an individual action that I take, especially a flight, because usually there's some very good reason for the flight. Like usually I'm going to a conference or I'm doing some reporting or it's a important family gathering or something like that. There's a reason I can justify it. But with Spain, it was sort of just like I just wanted to go drink wine in a Barcelona bar and I wanted to mountain bike around, you know, vineyards and cava vineyards. And I mean, that was it. It was frivolous. And so I couldn't really justify in my mind why I was making that flight. And I guess I could have if I didn't have a newsletter with tens of thousands of people who are interested in what I'm doing every day, especially tens of thousands of climate change concerned people who I'm generally pretty open with about what I'm doing. So I was already feeling some guilt just because of that. And that was before coronavirus had hit really substantially the United States. And by the time I came back, 2 weeks later, it had absolutely taken over everything. And paired with the guilt I was already feeling, I realized that once I got back that we were all voluntarily self-isolating. Our governments hadn't yet told us to self-isolate, but we were all doing it. And if I hadn't done it, I would have... It's not like the government would have punished me, but my friends and my family would have been like, what's wrong with you? Stay in your apartment, you know? And I realized at that moment that there was far more power in individual pressure to get the rest of us to kind of fall in line and protect people, because that's really what this is about, protecting people, than I had given it credit for. Especially in those early weeks of coronavirus, it mattered, not only because the social pressure from individuals, it also, I think, pressured state, local, federal politicians to also get their acts together and put in stay-at-home orders and put in shelter-in-place orders. There was more power in individual action than I thought, and it made me think to myself, you know, maybe I do have more of a responsibility, especially as somebody who talks about climate change a lot, to walk my talk a little bit more, just because it shows people that we're all just trying to save millions of lives. Like, we're all in a global crisis together. And yeah, it's not the biggest thing that I can do, but it's not about my personal carbon footprint. It's about showing to other people that I care about other people, that I care about saving people from climate change.
Yeah. And this is like what I think has always kind of like tied me in a knot when it came to talking about individual action, because it is like an objective fact that my personal impact on atmospheric CO2 is not going to substantially alter the trajectory of global temperatures. But it is also true that if enough people did the things that you know, people have been saying that we can all do, that would have an impact. And so I guess, like, it seems like some sort of messaging campaign where you're hearing the same message repeated over and over from your friends, from your family, from the media, from your government, it actually would be a pretty effective climate strategy that maybe we shouldn't take off the table.
Well, and I think the lesson here is that you actually can't take any strategy off the table when it comes to climate change. Yeah. That's the problem with climate change solutions in general, is that no one thing makes that big of a difference. Even if we had regulations in place for coal plants or regulations in place for oil refineries, which we used to, but now we don't, no one of those things makes a huge dent either, because it's a global problem that needs that, and we need that to happen in every single country. But that doesn't mean you don't do those things. It means you do all of those things, because the choice is either doing all of them or giving up, and giving up means losing millions of lives. That's the easiest way I can put it. And so we do have science in front of us that says that if all of us changed our diet, for example, there's this, it's called the Lancet Climate Diet, is one example that showed that if we all started eating this very Mediterranean-like diet, that would have, you know, that would take a significant chunk of carbon emissions out of the air. And that's not enough. That's not enough at all. But it's something. And if we're going to do what scientists tell us is necessary, we need to do a lot of things. And I think that what coronavirus has kind of taught me is that you can't take any option off the table.
I don't know who coined this, but there's something that has always sort of stuck with me, that when it comes to climate change, there is no silver bullet. There's silver buckshot.
What's buckshot? I'm from New York.
Buckshot is it's a shotgun ammunition where instead of like one slug, you get like a bunch of tiny, tiny little bullets.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry to turn this into a gun metaphor. That wasn't my intention.
It's definitely buckshot. You have to throw all the darts you have at the board and see which ones stick. But they also all have to stick.
Our producer, Justine Paradise, was also listening in on the call. And at this point, she jumped in with a question.
Do you think that I just want to sort of like push on this a little bit. Do you think that it's possible that because this is a health crisis and it might have like an immediate threat to you personally versus the like slightly more abstract climate crisis that like will, you know, kill millions of people, but like in a, that's been one of the challenges, right? That it like feels a little bit more like far off or an abstract. Do you think that the coronavirus pandemic like is sort of unique at all in that sense?
Yeah, definitely. Especially in terms of the big challenge with coronavirus and climate change, and that comparison is that they're both extreme health threats, right? They both threaten millions of lives. But with coronavirus, we can get a test that says it was coronavirus. Whereas with climate change, you can't really get a test that says that your loved one died from climate change. Your loved one will die from the effects of climate change that manifest in a much more insidious way. The number one way you could potentially know that a loved one died from climate change is if they died in a wildfire or an extreme weather event like a hurricane, or if they were, you know, a farmer who committed suicide after years of flooding made it so unlivable for them. That was a story I did a couple years ago, which is dark. I know it's dark. But you don't have a test for, you know, my loved one died from this other infectious disease that is spreading faster due to climate change, or my loved one died from respiratory problems that were exacerbated by living next to a refinery. You can't deny that coronavirus killed someone you loved. We know this about climate change. You can look it in the face and deny it, and it's easy.
It does feel like the COVID-19 pandemic shows us simultaneously the power of individual action and the importance of public information campaigns to prompt that individual action, but simultaneously also the limits of such actions. Because if you look at the countries that have been most successful in containing the pandemic, they're ones that have had huge, large-scale government programs of ramping up testing and testing every individual who presents with symptoms and isolating them at, you know, facilities where they're out of their home.
Yeah, I definitely want to reinforce the notion that even though I have come out of coronapocalypse with a bigger appreciation for individual action, or at least the power of what it can do, that's only in the circumstances that we're in now with both coronavirus and climate change in the United States, where we're in a situation where our governments have already failed to act. We've already failed to have systemic action on such a fundamental level. Basically, individual action is a powerful tool when we have already messed everything up systemically to an incredible degree. And it is in no way a substitute for systemic action, and in some ways coronavirus has cemented even further what I've been saying for years, which is that the only way we actually solve global crises, the only way we actually solve problems of to this scale that threaten millions of lives, is having government leaders, media, and corporate leaders who take science really seriously and that don't ignore threats. You see in New Zealand the incredible example of what happens when you have swift systemic change. You know, they're not only flattening the curve, they're destroying the curve. It's incredible to see. And whereas coronavirus has shown me that individual action isn't worthless, it's also shown me that systemic action is the most powerful still. But it's not one or the other, it's everything.
Emily, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Atkin is the creator of Heated, a newsletter and podcast for people who are pissed off about the climate crisis. Up next on Outside In, a corrective to the very popular but very problematic Netflix documentary, Tiger King. That's after a short break. Hello, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I am Sam Evans Brown, and today on the show, we're going to engage in something that we rarely get the chance to, pop culture commentary. So should we just start with the Netflix series Tiger King, and should people watch it or not?
Well, I guess that's a personal decision that everybody should make for themselves.
This is Rachel Neuer.
I'm a freelance journalist and author of the book Poached: Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking.
If you have not heard, Tiger King is a Netflix series, a reality TV show about one of the nation's most infamous tiger breeders, a man who is now in prison in part for conspiring to kill a woman named Carol Baskin, who runs a sanctuary for tigers that people bought as pets when they were cute, tiny cubs, and gave them away when they realized they had purchased a tiger. It kind of seems like everybody stuck at home right now has watched this show. And yes, it is full of drama. But Rachel says there are some ethical issues that viewers might not be aware of.
The show is like 7 hours of, you know, ridiculous antics, insane characters, entertainment. It'll definitely make you forget about the pandemic we're currently in. But if you're looking for something, though, that is going to educate you and make you not feel kind of like slimy afterwards, then Tiger King might not be the best option. It really misses a great opportunity for raising awareness about the big cat crisis in our country right now. You know, there's more tigers privately owned in the U.S. than are left in the wild. But, you know, that's an editorial decision. Not everybody has to make a bleeding heart documentary about saving animals. I totally get that. For me, I think the biggest thing the film actually gets wrong is it editorially portrays the two sort of main characters as equals. So this guy, Joe Exotic, you know, who's currently in federal prison for 17 counts of wildlife crimes and 2 counts of murder for hire, is basically portrayed as being on the same playing field morally as the woman he tried to have killed, Carol Baskin, which just is not true. You know, Joe Exotic was one of the biggest breeders and sellers of big cats, both legally and illegally, in the country for years. Carol Baskin, on the other hand, is a bona fide sanctuary owner. She doesn't breed or sell cats, and she's made it her entire mission in life to stop the breeding and the ownership of private big cats in this country.
I'm going to read a piece from a story in The Atlantic on this point, which calls the show's treatment of Baskin an egregious display of false equivalence. Here's the quote. "Baskin," Tiger King painstakingly lays out, "is obsessed with animal print. The horror! Sometimes she wears flower crowns. She has an uncanny gift for search engine optimization. She rides a bicycle. Her sanctuary relies heavily on unpaid volunteers." The show underscores all of these facts while making the most of the mysterious disappearance of Carol's husband in 1997 and interviewing family members who seem convinced that she killed him. There is absolutely no physical evidence at this time implicating any one individual as a suspect, a police detective firmly and rather crushingly points out. Tiger King doesn't care. It would much rather simply imply several times that she could have fed her husband's corpse to tigers had she been so inclined.
Yeah, exactly. So this was an incident in 1997. Carol Baskin's ex-husband, Don Lewis, disappeared. And of course, there was like all kinds of investigations. Carol hired a private investigator herself, and nothing ever turned up. There's zero evidence of, foul play. But of course, people who don't like Carol immediately pointed and said, like, oh yeah, she must have like killed him and fed him to the tigers. And this is a narrative that has been repeated for literally like over a decade by Joe Exotic as a way to, you know, slander Carol and, you know, get people to chase down this rabbit hole of Don Lewis's disappearance. We don't know if Carol had anything to do with his disappearance at all. There's zero evidence. Like, maybe she did, maybe she didn't. But I also found it really irresponsible to spend, you know, an entire episode just basically airing out people's grievances and allegations against her, and also painting a really one-sided picture of the story. So Carol, in an interview with me last week, told me that, in fact, she'd never been consulted about this. She never had a chance to respond to these allegations because she didn't know they were doing an entire episode about them. There's one, there's a scene where Carol, like, it sounds like she's dismissing Don Lewis's family members' concerns. She says something like, oh, well, these people are driven by ego and greed or livelihoods or something. She was in fact asked about, what would you say to Joe Exotic and people like him, not what would you say to Don Lewis's family. But the way it's edited, it seems like she's just dismissing this missing guy's family.
Rachel Neuer has also co-created her own series about Joe Exotic. But her story, let's just say, if you read what she's written and listen to her podcast, it will make you see Tiger King in a very different light. It's a 4-episode podcast series put out by Longreads called Cat People, and it talks about the phenomenon of rampant big cat ownership by private individuals in the United States. If you listen to Rachel's series, you'll learn a lot of fascinating stuff about the peculiar American stew of policy and circumstance that have made it very easy for private citizens to own 500-pound wild animals in the United States, like something called the generic tiger loophole, the zoo babies craze, and about an event that Rachel describes as animal-driven terrorism, in which a man released dozens of his pet carnivores outside a city of 25,000 people. I do really recommend the whole series, but we're going to play for you the third episode because it seems to me like the one that most serves as a necessary corrective to the Joe Exotic narrative. You'll hear Rachel narrating the story, being interviewed by her co-host, Peter Frick Wright.
So can you tell me what we're doing?
We are trying to navigate this traffic on our way to Big Cat Rescue, and I can see the yellow sign. So if a big cat owner, like remember Deb Pierce from the last episode, finds themselves completely overwhelmed with their big cats, as many of them do, they can, okay, sell them to a stranger if they can find someone gullible enough to take that bait. Or their best option is to donate these cats to a sanctuary.
And who are we going to talk to?
We are going there to see Carol Baskin, who is the founder of this organization. And the issue they run into there is while there are these quote-unquote sanctuaries around the U.S., a lot of them are just sanctuary in name, and they're actually just fronts for breeding animals, for this whole cub petting thing. There's only a few bona fide true sanctuaries that are actually accredited and do legitimate, you know, sanctuary work.
Oh, there's a little cat. Hi there. We're gonna see your.
It looks like my cat Lloyd.
Oh, a little gray. Oh my goodness, we're gonna see your relatives.
Probably the most well known of those places is Big Cat Rescue in Tampa, Florida. I wanted to come here because if it is gonna be possible to solve our country's big cat problem, the solution is probably going to come from here.
Hi, and welcome to Big Cat TV. Big Cat Rescue is one of the largest accredited sanctuaries dedicated entirely to big cats.
How big is this park?
I don't know. I'm very curious to find out.
Situated on 67 acres in Tampa, Florida, we provide a permanent home for a variety of species of rescued exotic cats.
It's right off the interstate, you know, probably like a 20-minute drive from downtown Tampa and the water. Let's do it. You walk in and there's this like gift shop covered in every possible like cat-themed thing you can imagine.
The pink leopard print golf cart.
And I wasn't a normal tourist, so I didn't have to wait for a tour, but if like anyone else wanted to visit, you would join a group tour. It's only like set times per day. And you walk around this sanctuary. It's all outdoors. And it's just cage after cage of various types of big and exotic cats that people have not wanted and have just basically dumped at this place, Big Cat Rescue.
Wow, $39 for your tour fee. It's pretty steep.
So you say sanctuary, I think green space and, you know, wild sort of like a zoo kind of thing.
It's definitely not a zoo. You can't just like buy a ticket and get some popcorn and like walk around. What you are going to do is you're going to learn about why big cats do not make good pets. And you're going to learn about why the U.S. should really think about tightening its rules about big cat ownership.
We also provide educational videos like biggest cat that purrs and meows, videos on how we do things at the sanctuary, and most importantly, what needs to be done to end the abuse and suffering of big cats, and what you can do to help.
And who's doing the teaching?
So the teaching's done by a guide, but the teaching really originates from the ideas of Carol Baskin and her husband, Howard.
I'm Rachel. I have an appointment with Carol.
All right.
Yes. Thank you.
Just tell her to go away. Rachel, I'm Howard.
Oh, Howard. It's wonderful to meet
nice
you.
Nice to meet you. Hi.
I'm
you.
Anna.
Anna?
Hi.
Hi, Rachel. It's so nice to finally meet you.
Anna
meet
or
you.
Hannah?
Anna.
Anna.
Yes. Okay.
With no hands to shake.
With no hands. Yes. I'm very sorry.
Carol. She is interesting.
I'm Carol Baskin, C-A-R-O-L-E.
She's tall and she often dresses like what I picture a Woodstock attendee dressing like. She'll literally wear like garlands of flowers in her hair. And, you know, she's got long blonde hair down to her waist, big blue eyes. And Howard is like pretty much the opposite of Carol. He has this kind of like turtle walk he does.
I'm Howard Baskin, and Carol's husband, and I handle mostly our administrative tasks.
I think he had like a pen in his shirt pocket when I met him. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he had a calculator hiding somewhere. They even say like we're opposites, but we work so well together.
Well, take me through your time that you spent with them, your tour of the property and things.
Yeah, I was so eager to talk to them. So I was just like antsy to like sit them down and ask all my questions. But they're like, let's start with the tour. So do tours begin in this room?
Yes, we take people out, 20 people at a time.
Okay. And we got into this like glorified like jumbo golf cart. And so we're driving around the property and it's quite wooded, you know, think like oak trees, again, palmettos everywhere, Spanish moss, like leaves all over the ground.
So how many residents do you have at the moment?
I have right around 60.
Of how many species?
That's a good question. There's lions, tigers, leopards, cougars, servals, bobcats, caracals, hybrid cats, an ocelot, and a jaguar. And a Siberian lynx.
It's kind of like these wired cages, and inside are just various cats. They each have their own enclosure, usually, you know, napping on like kind of like rock structures or under a tree.
And during the regular tours, the tour guide has an iPad, and each guest gets a receiver. And so the tour guide can interact with them and talk, but as they come to the cats, the tour guide can press the button, play the cat story.
Oh, cool.
And that way it keeps the stories consistent.
One of the stories that really stood out to me was this serval.
So this was someone's pet?
Yeah, actually a lady in New York had six of these in her basement in what looked to be like a little dungeon.
And I hadn't really seen a serval before. They're kind of like, imagine like a leopard that's been shrunk to the cocker spaniel side and then stretched out. So it has like really long, thin, tall legs, but then the kind of leopardy spots. And you know, they look small enough that you can manage them, but they're not.
And each couple of years she would buy a new kitten because they're only fun to play with for the first few months or to the first couple of years. And then they become who they are and they bite and they scratch and people don't want them at that point, but she just kept stockpiling them. And then she ended up in a situation where her sister abandoned her children to this woman. She found out she had cancer. Her house went into foreclosure.
And you know, tragedy hit this particular individual, but it was sort of lucky for the servals. The serval I saw looked like it was very much enjoying its life.
How old is he?
I'm thinking they have their signs on the cages, but I'm thinking he's like 19 or 20.
Oh, wow.
So Big Cat Rescue is kind of this retirement / foster home for unwanted big cats. But as long as there's big cat trade and ownership in this country, there's always going to be more animals to rescue. And you're never going to be able to rescue all of those animals. And Carol and Howard are definitely big picture kind of people. So after the tour, we sat down and I just said, you know, tell me everything. Start from the beginning. Tell me about this facility and also just what you're trying to do here.
I just recently was asked to find a photograph of myself with an animal, you know, an early photograph. And so my mother gave me some old family albums and I was pulling out the pictures and looking on the back to see if there was any further information. And there was a picture of me the day they brought me home from the hospital. My mother's holding me, my dad's holding a kitten, a little orange and white striped kitten. And on the back, it says the cat's name is Tiger. And it was like, well, I guess it's been destined from the very beginning because I had no idea that my first cat's name was Tiger.
So Carol Baskin's a really interesting and complex character. She, like many big cat people who now advocate for an end to big cat ownership, she used to be a part of the quote-unquote problem.
I never had any intention of rescuing big cats. I didn't know there was a problem. And it wasn't until I ended up at an auction where a taxidermist was going to kill a bobcat that I even discovered this was an issue.
She was in this real estate business with her ex-husband, and they would use llamas to kind of keep the yards of their properties in check. You know, Florida, things just like grow willy-nilly.
So we were at an exotic animal auction buying these llamas when the guy next to me starts bidding on this bobcat. And I had done bobcat rehab and release since I was 17 years old. So I leaned over to him and I said, when that cat grows up, she is going to tear your face off. And he said, I'm a taxidermist. I'm just going to club her in the head in the parking lot. And so there was no way that cat was going to get killed that day while I was there. And so she came home with us.
And Carol like freaked out. She said she started crying. Her ex-husband bit on the bobcat, so that was their first exotic cat, this bobcat.
And she was a holy hellion around the house and was terrorizing my husband and my daughter and our German Shepherd. And so we started calling around, trying to find somebody that would have somebody she could play with that she wouldn't tear to pieces. And my husband found a guy in Minnesota who said, I'll sell you a kitten, but you have to come in person.
They drove up there, and it turned out that he wasn't a bobcat breeder for pets. He was a bobcat breeder for fur. And Carol, again, just like freaked out, and they wound up coming home with 50-plus baby bobcats and lynxes.
50-plus?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm like rushing over these stats because it's so like ingrained in my head. But yeah, imagine that, like 50 kittens. Like even normal kittens, that would be way too many kittens. Yeah. But they were just like, yeah, this'll work. This is a good idea.
So the next year we got the adults out of there. We had to come home and build cages and that sort of thing. And that was the beginning of the sanctuary.
Cat People and Outside In continue after a short break.
So they open a sanctuary and they call it Wildlife on Easy Street. This place is really nothing like Big Cat Rescue is today, because at that time it was more just a place that attracted other big cat lovers who wanted to basically play with and interact with big cats one-on-one. You could even spend $75 and sleep with a big cat in a cabin for the night. Carol was also breeding a bunch of these smaller exotic cat species, because she was under the impression that if she just makes more of these endangered species, she's actually helping them, because then there's, you know, more of these cats in the world and they're less endangered.
It happened at a time before the internet was available to us, all of this learning that we were doing. And the only people that we could learn from at that period of time were the breeders and dealers. And they were saying, oh, you should breed these animals because they're endangered. They said the zoos don't know what they're doing and they're going to disappear in the wild. And so we thought, well, that's something that we could definitely do to help save the cats.
Like as if they might sustain a wild population someday. If push came to
maybe
shove.
Or I don't really know what goes through people's heads when they're thinking that, if they're thinking like, oh, they can be introduced into the wild, or if they're just thinking like, oh, their mere existence like makes the species less endangered and, you know, just like completely cut off from how conservation works. You know, a species has to be in its environment playing a role to actually sort of matter. Carol, meanwhile, you know, she's breeding these cats and she's selling them to other people so that, you know, they can do the same or whatever. But within, you know, a year or so, she starts noticing that people are bringing their now grown kittens back to her, because they're like, you know, dear Lord, I cannot deal with this bobcat, like please take it back.
And then I started going to the conferences for the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and I discovered that none of these cats that are in private hands serve any kind of conservation value, and so there's just no reason to be breeding these cats in private hands.
And for Carol, that's like it's like a switch goes off. She does a 360 and she's like, okay, no more breeding cats. I was wrong. I'm going to neuter and spay all my animals and start working on a way to reduce big cat ownership, because it's just contributing to a problem rather than solving it.
I mean, it sounds like Carol went from being the like cliche big cat person to like someone who actually looks this problem in the eye and then changes a bit.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, Carol has a lot of critics. A lot of people do not like Carol because they perceive her as, you know, a threat to their rights, their big cats. And they like to call her a hypocrite, and they like to point to her past, you know, 20 years ago. And one of the first things you'll see if you Google her name and come across some of these articles is allegations that Carol murdered her first husband. So her first husband, he basically walked out the door one day and he was never heard from again. No one could find any clues, nothing. But no evidence was ever actually found linking her to anything to do with his disappearance. So that brings us to Howard, who's really the unsung hero of Big Cat Rescue. Carol founded this sanctuary in the 90s, and Howard came on board in the 2000s. Before Howard came on, you know, Carol's project had a lot of heart behind it, but organizationally, things were a mess. Howard worked over Carol's spreadsheets and he developed a business plan for her. He took things from Carol's passion project to creating an actual functioning nonprofit organization.
My profession was going into small businesses where the entrepreneur had started it.
So Howard specializes professionally in basically cleaning up the accounting mess of small businesses to enable them to grow.
I did a series of those and it takes breaks in between. And during one of those breaks, I met Carol.
Where did you guys meet?
Well, the full story, and then you can edit it, okay?
So Carol and Howard met through a mutual friend who was throwing a fundraiser to help lower euthanasia rates for dogs and cats.
Friday night, there's this event at the aquarium, just 30 people, great speaker, would you come to that? I said, okay. So I get in my suit and trundle on down to the aquarium, which closes at 5.
There was some mix-up with the time on the invitation, so Carol and Howard arrived at the same time and were the first and only two people there.
So what do? You turn and you say, hi, and there was this very attractive woman behind me. I said, are you going to this pet thing? And she said, yes. And I said, and how does it happen that you're coming to this? And she said, well, I'm the founder of Wildlife on Easy Street and was used to hearing, what's that? And I said, oh, I've been there.
Well, I would have just married him right then. Somebody that actually knew about us.
So we get up to the room, and there's this gorgeous setup with a buffet and candlelight and a bar and a bartender across the way, and nobody else is there. I go to the bartender, and he said, well, it doesn't start till 5:30. So I came back to Carol, and I was just in kind of a flippant mood, and I looked her very seriously, and I said, it turns out there's no function. She looked at me and said, well, what do you mean? I said, turns out the whole thing is a sham that Mary set up just so you and I would meet.
What year was that?
That was in 2002. That was November 1st is the day we met at the aquarium, right?
And were the big cats a turn-on or a turn-off that this was part of the package?
They weren't.
Nobody's ever asked you that before.
Oh, that's why I'm struggling. They were neither.
In Carol, Howard really saw a project. You know, he saw someone beautiful and motivated that, you know, he was attracted to and wanted to help. But more than that, he saw a chance to really fix things for her sanctuary and move things forward in the same way that he did for small businesses throughout his career.
What happened was Carol brought me out of the sanctuary that January after a few dates. And I kind of have this natural, I don't know, instinct or almost addiction to fix it, you know? And so I made the big mistake of saying, maybe I could help.
Apparently on their honeymoon, Carol and Howard wrote out this like 20 or 25 year plan of like their life mission to stop big cat ownerships. They call it to stop the bad guys from exploiting big cats.
So we're like 15 years into their 25 year plan.
Yeah, I mean, they've made some pretty good progress, though, on this plan. Carol, over the years, has built up this ginormous online following. She does like a live stream video practically every day. They are avid Facebook posters. And I mean, they have like over 1 million people following their operations and donating to them. And they're really using that following to their advantage to achieve the goals that they've set out to do. So one of the first really big things they did was the closure of this thing called the generic tiger loophole.
That rule in 1998, Fish and Wildlife Service said.
So the generic tiger loophole, you might remember, there's all those mutt tigers. They're no longer the six subspecies that occur in the wild. They're just complete American mutts. And the Fish and Wildlife Service decided, hey, we're not going to regulate these mutt tigers. protections under the Endangered Species Act won't apply to them, and that allowed those tigers to be freely traded around the country.
So it created this just open door for these people to breed. The only solution is to change the laws so this isn't happening. But it takes forever to get a rule made or changed.
So back in 2011, they linked up with major nonprofit organizations who kind of were aligned on the same vision. And they all, as a group, decided, like, okay, like, this is one of our big goals, and we're going to get this done. So Carol and Howard pretty much just sicked their huge social media following on this issue. And then they had their followers absolutely inundate Fish and Wildlife with 15,000 comments saying, yeah, close the loophole, close the loophole. Like, 15,000. Wow. So, like... Yeah, so Fish and Wildlife was like, oh my gosh, like, fine, we'll close the loophole, which they did in 2016.
What's the next thing that they are trying to do, or what did they do next?
So their sights are next set on passing federal legislation. So a bill that would actually give complete federal oversight to big cat ownership. And this bill is called the Big Cat Public Safety Act. And it would basically do two big things. First of all, it would ban any public physical contact with big cats. So this is like cub petting or like having a cheetah at your wedding that everyone's like taking photos with, things like that. The other thing that that federal oversight would do is force everybody who had a big cat to register it. And, you know, while it wouldn't ban big cat ownership outright, it would at least mean that we'd know, okay, where are all these cats? So, you know, if somebody like Terry Thompson decides to throw open the cages for his animals, you know, going in, like, okay, we have to find 12 tigers.
So, but it sounds like they're going to have to get Republican support behind something that is essentially adding governmental oversight to the lives of Americans. Like, it seems like a difficult thing to do.
Yes. And if they were coming at this only from this tree hugger, let's save the big kitties point of view, it would probably be impossible. But the secret weapon in their arsenal of support is the public safety part of the Big Cat Public Safety Act.
Over here, this is what I've been very successful with big cats right here, is an umbrella.
Now, so Tim Harrison retired from his job as a cop slash firefighter slash paramedic, but he hasn't really retired from that world. What he does now is he spends his time traveling all over the country, training first responders with how to deal with, for example, a tiger that they find in a house.
And you see a tiger or a lion in somebody's home or something like that, and you need to back them off a little bit, and you don't want to shoot them at that time. What happens is you come at him with your umbrella, and he freak out. Big cats absolutely freak out.
So the rules of engagement with a tiger are like try and move it via umbrella.
Yeah. Also being like a very calm. I mean, Tim says his ultimate goal is safety for animals and also safety for people. It's the people part, though, that helps them make a case for this new law.
One of the political contexts here that you have to understand is that for us, on the Republican side, the story has a lot more weight when you kind of talk about the public safety aspect of it.
This is Ryan O'Dwyer, a lobbyist that came to Florida for the Republican National Convention a few years ago. He happened to go to Big Cat Rescue, and he's been working with Howard and Carol in Washington ever since.
Especially in Washington, when we're trying to gain Republican favor, where they're not so keen on the idea of federal empowerment over an issue like this, we can say, well, look, you know, are you against protecting our first responders?
The other thing about this legislation is it's not just about protecting first responders or lowering the number of these American tigers. It doesn't really seem like there would be a connection between tigers in captivity here in the U.S. and tigers living in the wild. But because there's a robust black market for tiger parts in Asia, any tigers in captivity can and do feed into the black market for tiger parts. And any availability of tiger parts is bad for tigers in the wild because it perpetuates demand for tiger products, and that encourages people to poach. as long as there's going to be money that can be made off of, you know, a dead tiger that someone kills in the wild, people will continue to pursue that activity. More than that, though, the fact that we have all these tigers in backyards and basements, and we don't even know how many we have, and, you know, it's completely legal in a lot of places, it affects the ability of U.S. diplomats to bring this point up with China. So when, you know, they go to China and they're like, hey, we would like you to get better about tiger conservation and crack down on the black market trade in your country, the Chinese just kind of laugh at them and are like, who are you to talk? You guys don't even know where all your tigers are. So the bill is making good progress in the House. It was reported out of the Committee on Natural Resources on September 18th, and since then, they've got 95 more co-sponsors. So they now have 220 co-sponsors signed up to support the bill there, and they're hoping it's going to be sent to the floor for a vote before the end of this year. If that happens, it's almost certainly going to pass. In the Senate, on the other hand, the bill was just introduced at the end of September, and so far it has 13 co-sponsors.
So if you had to give the Big Cat Public Safety Act a grade as far as like how far is it going to go to solve this problem, how good is it, would you say?
B, maybe B minus if I'm, you know, in a bad mood.
Okay. Why do you say?
Well, because you can still have big cats if you, you know, check all the boxes. I mean, that said, I do think the Big Cat Public Safety Act will go a really long way to stopping this problem, because you're just not going to have the same number of animals floating around kind of in need of a home because of that cub petting part of it.
Yeah.
It's like not only are there not going to be as many animals present or available, but you're also not planting the idea in people's head that like, oh, hey, I can have a tiger too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're living in this moment where the idea of owning a tiger is not ridiculous.
No, and not at all.
It has been ridiculous for most of history.
Yeah. It's weird that people need to be reminded of that, but that's where we're at right now.
This is the inside. The first time we did undercover, this is going to shock you right here. It's Inside Edition Undercover. I don't do much with Inside Edition, but nobody else would listen to me. So the boy got his arm ripped off by a neighbor's tiger. Every time these groups tell you, nobody gets injured. It's always the people that own the animals. It's a bunch of crap. We picked this out of 300 stories that year of children injured. This boy went right over to the neighbor's house, reached through to pet the tiger, and got his arm ripped off. Paramedics did a fantastic job. And the next little girl, beautiful little girl, her dad had a tiger. He jumped over him, played rough with her, and broke her neck. And people said, this is the dad here. He's a doctor, too. The sad part about this is people don't know what's going on. Well, we took them there. This is an auction in Amish country, Mount Hope, Ohio, biggest auction in the country at the time. Look at the crowd when you get in here. I don't know if we can turn the lights off. Look at the crowd. The crowd is massive. Look at that. Black leopard cubs, as fast as you can bring them out. As fast as you can bring them out, cougar cubs. So when somebody tells, look at the boxes over there. Look at the crowd. That's just one building. And all these animals are stacked on top of each other. They're all tigers, leopards, cougars. When people say, is cougars coming back to Ohio? No, they're being turned loose in Ohio. Now, when you get to the black leopard cubs, this is where you have a little problem. People see they're stacked on top. There's 13 of them right there, two on top down here. This is one I took out of a house in Dayton, Ohio. Look at the.
It was produced by Peter Frick Wright and Audrey Quinn, music and sound design by Robbie Carver, editing by Mike Dang and Chris Outcault, art by Zoe Van Dyke, and fact-checking by Matt Giles. If you enjoyed this episode of Cat People, you might also like an episode we did a while back. It's called Loser Wolves, A Cat Fancy, a deep dive look at the impulse to own a little piece of the wildness and beauty of a big cat, but this time through breeding.
It was sometime in the mid-80s, and Anthony was at the grocery store with his mom. While he waited for her to check out, he started flipping through the magazines by the register.
And one was one of those grocery store tabloids that had an article and full color photographs about a woman who created a domestic cat that looked like a leopard. I couldn't believe it. And then pictures of her holding one of them and pictures of one of the cats. They said, you know, they're $2,000, and she called them leopardettes.
By a stroke of luck, Anthony, at 11 years old, had stumbled across the founder of what would eventually be called the Bengal Cat.
You can find that episode, again called Loser Wolves, A Cat Fancy, by going to our website, outsideinradio.org, or on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Outside In is produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Justine Paradise, and Taylor Quimby. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is the director of Moving with the Grace of a Leopard, The Speed of a Cheetah, and The Heart of a Lion. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.